Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
This is A Cult of Personality podcast episode number 102, featuring an interview with Mark Knight, the author of the book Trinity of Wisdom, Truth, Philosophy, and Hermetic Alchemical Kabbalah. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. Thanks again to the subscribers of the Occult of Personality membership section who fund each and every show, as well as the generous listeners who click the donate button on the website to sponsor this episode, namely Artovan, Steve, Stefan, and Mike. Thanks again. It's your financial support that helps make these podcasts a reality, and it is greatly appreciated. Now, in episode number 102, our guest, Mark Knight, the author of Trinity of Wisdom, Truth, Philosophy, and Hermetic Alchemical Kabbalah. You can find Mark's website at wakeywakey.com. That's WAYKI, WAYKI.com. Mark is a mystic, and his work endeavors to raise human consciousness by utilizing techniques of the Western esoteric tradition. Mark Knight, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
That's fine, Greg. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Excited to speak with you. In order to get started with the interview, I think it would be nice if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your experience and background, and how you came to be involved in blogging and writing.
Okay, Greg. It's kind of an interesting story. Like many people, many years ago, I was in a sort of well-paid career. It was quite soulless. I was sort of wondering, this is what the world was all about. So I sort of just quit everything and went traveling. At the same time, I was sort of meditating, starting to do meditations, using theta wave technology, sort of opening up and starting to follow synchronicities. And see, the more I started trying to follow synchronicities, the more they would appear and spin up, so to speak. So this was quite an individual me thing. I was traveling and I was following synchronicities and meditating. And on this path, this led me through India, meeting some very rich and wise people, and led me on a Maya pilgrimage through Mesoamerica and with some various shaman. And this, of course, created a lot of experiences and shocks. I sort of believe only shock and experience really changed man. It's sort of during these years of traveling around and opening up spiritually that I wrote my first book called Wakey Wakey. This is very much looking at what many people now call the world conspiracy or the world elite. It's sort of a new look at the media and a lot of programming people get. And a lot of people are aware of, things like, terror attacks, these aren't real, and certain cabals that are sort of controlling many different groups in society. So sort of studying this. A lot of hidden history, ancient civilization, Greg. And my research to this point, it sort of stopped. I did the first book and I've been traveling. I sort of hit a dead end. And then more research showed me that the only way forward really was looking at ancient wisdoms. Things like what really resonated out of the ancient wisdoms were the Hermetics, the alchemy, and the Kabbalah. And that these were a very fundamental part of evolution of our species, of inventions, of history, and of hidden knowledge. And the synchronicities were still flying, Greg. So I ended up, just by chance, if there is such a thing as chance, an independent mystery school in Mesoamerica. It was quite intense there. It was like a 100-day process where one would live in a pyramid for 100 days. It would be 50 days of full-on theory. You'd be working at night in your dreams as well. And then it would go into a 50-day silent fast. Which was the practical, so it'd be half theory and half practical. Of course, with the fast, you'd be ingesting some liquids, sort of keep you alive, shall we say. This mystery school is sort of firmly based upon the mystical Kabbalah and the Kabbalion, two very well-known books. When used together, there were certain doors that open, one could say. And after this experience, I was obviously hungry for more and more. I was, the synchronicities were flying up. I was sent by this mystery school, which they didn't normally do. It took me to one side and they sent me to this guy high up a volcano in Mesoamerica who's sort of a master of the Emerald Tablet. And this would come down from a lineage that I never got to know too much about. And again, I did another 100-day process, which was 50-day theory on the Emerald Tablet, including a lot of particle physics and numerology, dream work, some parts of the Philosopher's Stone included. And there was another 50-day silent practical. And after all these experiences, I was like, well, I think it's time to maybe try and record some of this, because I had books of notepads everywhere, and I didn't want to spend the rest of my life with all these notepads and memories. I wanted to just get it out so I could move on with my life. That's sort of the background on how sort of ended up on your show, Greg, and how the new book came about.
That's very interesting. I'm tempted to ask, and I've heard rumors about an adept well known by his writings that we believe to be deceased, and I've heard these rumors somewhat persistently that he is still alive and teaching in the Andes Mountains or somewhere in South America. And I'm just curious, because you're the first person I've spoken with who mentioned a teacher living in that area, and I'm just curious about the identity of this person.
I obviously can't reveal the person,
mm-hmm.
But I do. I had not heard his name before, and I've not heard it after.
Okay.
I don't. He's certainly not a writer or out in the field. Should we say?
Okay.
And he'll sit there for many years, and no one will go to him, and then the old person will be sent, and he'll sort of do his stuff. Should we say?
Fascinating. Mm. One of the things I wanted to bring up early on in our conversation is that you are very upfront in talking about and addressing what we typically refer to as the control system, conspiracy, modern society, and its faults, in addition to talking about ancient wisdom and its application to our lives today. Could you just briefly talk a little bit about the importance of writing about both of these subjects and maybe some thoughts about why it is that you are one of the few who does so?
Yeah, I can hopefully get into that a little bit, Greg. What I found was there's a lot of great Kabbalistic, Hermetic doctrines, but the writer doesn't look up at what's going on at that time. I mean, there are some great doctrines written during the First World War, during the Second World War. Nothing was sort of applied to our Malkuth reality, should we say. It's like, okay, we can work with these archetypes, we can use these parts of the Kabbalah, and we can do this. But where's the application to what's going on with the species? There has to be a link, or we're just playing in dream world, are we not? We're trying to get ourselves clearer, more our consciousness more evolved, so we can move as a species. I mean, I come from the background of studying the conspiracy, the world conspiracy, whatever you want to call it, the world elite, the control system. But from my experience with the Emerald Table, I mean, at the Emerald Tablet, I went so far away in my being that when I came back, I saw everything brand new, Greg. It was like I'd just first arrived on the planet. I remember going to Guatemala City, and I was horrified at the billboards. I could feel the corporate energy behind the billboards. I could see people just wanting adoration of the other sex and wanting gadgets. And I could really feel that low consciousness and that control mechanism in a way I'd never felt it before. And as time goes on, I hear more and more people, they're paying these taxes, they're working in these jobs, and it's just a constant struggle. And with how evolved our consciousness naturally is, our natural state, we shouldn't be living like this. We can even look back to people like Krishnamurti in the 1950s who really looked at this sort of programming of the mind. You know, I look at Krishnamurti more as an anarchist than a spiritualist. It's all about freedom. I mean, surely spirituality is freedom, and how evolved we are on this planet compared to all the other beings. We should be able to live in more harmony and with more freedom. And if when we're studying the ancient texts and the ancient doctrines, and we're working practically with hermetics, surely we need to be bringing something back to help in some way. It's not enough to go, okay, I'm a hermetic master, I invoke all these elementals, I invoke this, and I manifest this. That's all ego, is it not? That's all for the self. So we need to start using these ancient wisdoms to apply them to our world around us, or there's just no point, or it's just like a hobby. You might as well go and play golf, you know?
Yeah.
I really feel strongly about this, Greg. I really do. Because I come from I come the other way around. I sort of did a lot of Kabbalistic and Hermetic practical, and then I afterwards read lots and lots of doctrine to fill in the gap. It wasn't the other way around. I was sort of pulled by the ear and thrust into some very big experiences I was obviously open to. So I just see it a bit differently.
Now, I've heard the perspective that a lot of what we observe around us in terms of conspiracies and political machinations and economic and political systems of control. And some people put forth the perspective that, as you mentioned earlier, the only way that mankind learns is through experience. And usually the lesson is only learned through a harsh experience, something that's uncomfortable or difficult or some kind of challenge. And yeah. I've heard people say things like, well, the only way for humanity to change is to go through these very difficult and dark experiences. Otherwise, we can't get out of this materialistic mindset that humanity seems to be somewhat locked into right now.
Yeah, I believe there is a natural trajectory to this, Greg. But of course, we can also help ourselves. There's a great comment, I think Michael Zarian said, this is the required friction to sharpen the knife. So no one's going to be waking up to self-empowerment, to spirituality, or to freedom if there's no grindstone, no friction. So when someone gets controlled and controlled and controlled, a bit like trying to squash an ant, it will struggle to survive. So, you know, the tide goes in and out, the moon waxes and wanes, empires come and go, you know, Egypt came and went, Greece came and went, and this globalization empire's only really been standing strong since the Second World War. This is nothing. I mean, this system's going to go. It doesn't take a genius to see the system's going to go. And it's natural.
Yeah,
it's a natural thing.
And your point is well taken in regards to, like, the idea that a sword is not forged in a feather bed. It's in a furnace of great heat. And I also, you know, your point about that we have to help ourselves through it as well. We can't just sit back and wait for the change to occur is also
sure.
Very
and I do
valid.
Believe a lot of these 2012 consciousness websites, I believe some of these are controlled, Greg. A lot of them are saying, sit back, do nothing. It's all going to be all right. 2012's coming. And I believe this is a message from the wrong side, shall we say. Because whatever we do helps shape the collective consciousness, and that will help shape the future. I really believe this.
Yeah, indeed.
Because we're all one part of the all, a bit like in our body, we're all the cells. Each cell is a part of the whole. It's a complete fractal of that.
So I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about the beginning of your book, Trinity of Wisdom. Trinity of
That's
Wisdom.
Fair.
Truth, Philosophy, and Hermetic Alchemical Kabbalah.
That's fine, Greg. I often just call it TOW, so you're longer than I am. So.
Now, you begin the book talking about where are we now?
Yes.
And you get into rather extensively describing and analyzing society, political and economic systems, the way that we fit into these systems, or in most cases don't really fit into these systems. I'd like to just spend a few minutes talking about this in a little more detail, but I don't want to really belabor it too much, but because I think people listening to us right now are somewhat familiar with these ideas.
Yes.
We've seen, even in the mainstream media, we've seen JFK, we've seen the Gulf of Tonkin, we've seen 9/11 in particular, I think woke a lot of people up in some respects.
Yes.
But what is going on here?
Yeah, well, this was only supposed to be a couple of pages, Greg, really, originally, but I think I got carried away a little bit. And again, I think this goes back to my sort of conspiracy research background and coming back from the Emerald Tablet process with completely new eyes, like I just landed on the planet. I thought it's good to get something down. Mm-hmm. It does very much look like people are just being forced to be workers, consumers, in debt, and just to be diverted with entertainment. It really does look like that. And you can work your way up and you can look at media, looks very controlled, a lot of the education system, the university, even in science and history, sponsorship looks a bit ill when you look at it. Then you've got the intelligence agencies, the military, the black ops. It doesn't look good. And you can even look at some bodies that everyone thinks are good, you know, the EU, the UN, the World Trade Organization, the FDA, and the EPA. I think it's the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, these really solid pillars of our system in the world, when you get into them deep enough, it just doesn't look good. And this crosses the board with the food we're eating, the things in the newspaper, our kids' television. It really does look bad. But on the first chat, people say, hey, that's a bit crazy, you're a paranoid conspiracy theorist. Not. That's okay. I just ask people to look at it themselves, you know? I mean, why is aspartame in your food? Why are your kids being diagnosed with ADHD when this can just be fixed with the TV taken away and a bit of organic food? You know, it really doesn't look good. And at the top, I mean, the banks, the IMF, I mean, for me at the moment, Greece isn't really a country anymore, nor is Ireland. They both belong to the IMF. I mean, they're not really sovereign countries anymore, or whatever a sovereign country was anyway. But, I mean, these central banks are gobbling up whole countries. They own these countries. They practically own the people. I mean, I know a lot of people who have told me, because I'm in Europe at the moment, a lot of people are leaving Ireland. They're just getting out because their grandkids and their grandkids are going to be paying off this massive debt to the IMF. They use the word bailout, but this is a gimmick. The real word is we're giving you a loan and want a lot more back at interest. This is one side of it. But then we can go to the other side and look at big companies like Monsanto, DuPont, Enron, WorldCom, Exxon, Chevron, BP, Shell, Halliburton, KPMG, Procter & Gamble. It just goes on and on. And the more you look into it, the more it just gets more and more shocking. But I think everyone who is coming to this sort of information and is interested has to look at it themselves. There is no Pied Piper to follow. There is no documentary to watch, because in this information war, there's really no one to trust. It's a real minefield out there.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think with people looking at ancient spiritual wisdom and really trying to cultivate what these texts mean and working on themselves, I think you have to be aware also of what's going on in the world around us. Because there are some dark people who are trying to control us, and there are technologies around, and technologies taken away, such as free energy is taken away. It just goes on and on, Greg. And I studied this for many years, and this is a passion, of course, because it affects us. And I got a bit carried away. I ended up doing, I don't know, 50 pages, was it, I think, Greg?
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't say carried away. I think What I took away from it is this is an important statement about, as you say, where are we right now?
Yeah. It's very hard to ask that question. I mean, you're coming from work, you know, gets me out of the fridge, got to wash some clothes, I'm going to meet a friend, da-da-da-da-da-da. When do we ever stop and say, where are we now, let alone where am I now? It's so hard to find the space and the clearness to actually ask those questions. And, of course, there's the what can I do apathetic thoughts, or what can I do, you know? Oh, they are doing this, oh God. I mean, England's the worst place in the world for it, Greg, where I was born. I mean, people are moaning all the time, but they never do anything. I mean, moaning was in the Olympics. I mean, England should be on the gold medal, I'll tell you.
Well, it always reminds me of a couple of quotes. There's that one about a group of small, dedicated people changing the world, and that's the only thing that ever really has changed the world. And then I think it was David Southwell who actually wrote something like, the biggest secret in the world is that you can't change the world. And once you realize that, the biggest question is why you don't get up off your ass and do something about it.
Yeah. There's another great quote by, I think it's Victor Hugo, an 1800s author. He said, there is one thing stronger than all the armies of the world, and that is an idea whose time has come.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, an idea, a thought form, can be from one person, or it can be from a government, or it can be from a nation. I mean, an idea is an idea, and if it's good, it will manifest. If its trajectory is correct with the current evolution, it will manifest. Pretty much how it works.
Now, before we leave the topic of where are we now and conspiracy and systems of control, there's just one other area I'd like to hear your opinions about, and that's the way that conspiracy has been denigrated in popular culture to almost like a clownish type of concept, where people who espouse conspiracy theories are ridiculed and brushed aside and considered marginal. They're completely marginalized, essentially. I know that seems to be changing, but I'd also like to hear your thoughts about how much a part of the system of control this is in itself, because we are constantly confronted by people who talk about facts and real information and then will take it to the next step. And the next thing, you know, they're talking about JFK or 9/11. And the next thing you know, we're off into UN world government. And from my perspective, if you look at the history, the JFK or 9/11 or what have you, it's very factually based for the most part. Not everyone is, but then when you get off into, well, where's this going? It's like it takes a hard turn into fantasy land.
Yeah, I've found this, and I believe there are, I mean, in the game, people call it trolls. There are people paid to crazy up the websites. When you dip your foot in the swimming pool to look at 9/11, someone yanks your foot and pulls you in the deep end, and you're all of a sudden in this crazy world of UFOs and aliens and crazy technologies and underground bunkers and hollow earth and all this crazy stuff that you're just never going to know. So they put caveats in place that when you start looking at the conspiracy genre, you know, the tangible stuff like 9/11, JFK, that you fall in, you slip on the oil, and you're in the swamp very quickly. I know personally some good friends who've looked at some stuff, and then after a month or two of looking at stuff, they end up going, "Whoa, I don't know what to believe. I don't believe anything anymore. It just gets too crazy because the websites have really diluted down with loads of stuff, disinformation. This is what happens. I mean, I don't want to put down anyone's research or anything, but it's very easy. Someone said to me, if they're looking for umbrellas, if you're looking for umbrellas, you'll find them everywhere. So if someone's writing a book or doing some research about something, it's very easy to pull stuff into that. It's a minefield, the conspiracy genre. It just is a minefield. I mean, and a lot of it's controlled. I mean, I have questions about WikiLeaks. I mean, I have concerns about whether they are a tool to shape the political map or whether they're a tool to shut down or control the internet. You know, I have questions about these people.
Right.
Or the people behind them. It gets that bad. It's such a minefield. And to be honest, I don't really look at too much anymore. I look at the actual mainstream news because I can see through it. And I just want to see it as comedy. I just see what they're putting out and try and see, well, who's to benefit, what's behind this. I try and stay away from these conspiracy forums now because there's a lot of trolls on there.
Mm.
And it theorizing and theorizing and theorizing, sitting on the computer theorizing, just doesn't really help much. It really doesn't. It doesn't do much at the end of the day. There's no action in that.
Mm. Well, that seems like a perfect point to depart from these topics and get into talking more about spirituality and practical methods and things like that. You mentioned that as you encountered ancient wisdom and things, that the Hermetic ideas really resonated with you. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I was in India for a while. I spent some time with some yogis and some Tibetan monks and some other people. And it was good. It was, you know, he taught me some good stuff. It was great. But I wanted to go a bit further. It was like, okay, here's some yoga and here's some meditation, here's some nice Eastern philosophy. Very nice, very tangible. We wanted a bit more, and it seemed that the Eastern side of things was a bit, I've got a Western mind, and the Eastern side of things just didn't really fix. There was all these alien words, Sanskrit words I'd have to have remembered, and I just thought, wow, this is really boring. And then I, due to my research of secret societies as well, I come across Hermetics and Kabbalah, and I just read a couple of books, and it really resonated, and then went deeper and deeper with it. It really does fit the Western mind. And you don't have to remember all these sort of Eastern words or Sufi words or from all these other parts of the world. I mean, well, yeah. I'm a Western guy. What? Why not? You know?
So you didn't find that the Hebrew was as difficult to deal with as Sanskrit or other?
No, because, I mean, I understand the Hebrew letters and their sounds and all their esoteric meanings.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them, should we say, you know, no one can declare to know all of them. But to actually read Hebrew out loud, I probably couldn't do it. You know, but I looked at the Hebrew as symbols, not really as a talking to anyone language
right.
to converse with. It was more like, that is a symbol from like a fire, because they're all very fiery, the Hebrew letters, aren't they?
Yes.
Almost burnt. And I looked at them as symbols of archetypes as opposed to an alphabet as I learnt it as a child to speak with. And I took to the Kabbalah very, very well. I just got a lot of it quite quickly and just got immersed in it and in its puzzles and in its beauty and in its depth. And maybe I'd looked at it before in a past life or something. I don't know, but it just really hit the spot, really. It was like I'd done it before, like I'd looked at it before. It was strange.
Very interesting. Very strange. Now, you spend a significant portion of the book discussing, I guess, what I would call energetics, how energy functions in the human body, and different ways that we can think about it and then try to affect it, I guess is how I would say it.
Sure. Well, this sort of goes back to the conspiracy chat. I mean, everything, a lot of things in our reality are quite an attack on our vibration, the food, the media. There's a lot of attacks on our, you know, we are electromagnetic eggs of energy. I mean, that's a fact. Even science backs that up now. And your Reiki healers and all the rest, that's pretty much a fact. And there's a lot of attacks on our vibrating frequencies. So there are some very simple methods of getting these in harmony, like retuning a guitar. I mean, it could be as simple as walking in nature, a little bit of silence, eating the right food. So I start off very, very tangible, starting to use your intuition more. A lot, especially men, you know, using the male archetype, we tend to be very much thought and intelligent, and we like to think, and sort of what I call stuck in hod, for those that know the tree of life.
Mm-hmm.
Men tend to be very hod, and they seem to think of it a bit scary to go along towards Netzach. So I was trying to look at things as, you know, a bit more balanced, a bit more intuition, because just using your intuition is probably one of the greatest spiritual practices anyone can do.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. You don't have to sit there and do like 400 mantras or anything. You just start using your intuition and things open up. So I started to look at this and energy, and then went on to the pineal gland and what's that, maybe some symbolism around that in throughout history and what we can do with that. I mean, obviously it's known as the third eye. I'm just looking at some like techniques and ways of raising our vibration before we enter any sort of deeper mysticism in the book, because this follows on very well from where the species is now. It's sort of like, well, if there's an attack on our vibration via these control mechanisms, well, first off the bat, I want to raise my vibration. So we start looking at frequencies, the nature of the mind, emotions, relieving stress, a few things like that. What is my purpose? How to ask yourself a few questions. What is the science of mantra? What is the science of pranayama? It's all very bite-sized as well, very tangible. So what I found is, Greg, a lot of books, you have a whole book on pranayama, a whole book on meditation, a whole book on this, and I like to crunch things up into one book, really, so that you cover a lot of ground.
Yeah, you absolutely did that. I think is fascinating, the way you were able to condense some of these subjects into their essence. One thing that comes to mind I wanted to ask you about, because your book incorporates, as you mentioned, like these ideas of new physics, or what some people have referred to as the science of consciousness,
yep.
and related it to ancient wisdom tradition. Do you have any concern in connecting these ancient traditions and philosophies with modern science?
No, I was a bit nervy myself, Greg. I know exactly what you're saying, but I sort of pictureized that the ancient wisdom is the train, and the words I was using from, let's say, modern science are just the decoration to help explain the ancient wisdom train.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like the ancient wisdom, it doesn't get affected, but I'm going to use words that can make it more explanatory. So, for instance, the word subconscious didn't exist only a few hundred years ago. The word archetype or synchronicity didn't exist a few hundred years ago. Hertz, measuring things in hertz, didn't exist. So I'm trying to use these sort of modern scientific words to help explain. It's like, I believe, the tree of life, if it was taught a few hundred years ago, it would be different to 400 years ago, to 200 years ago, to now, to a few hundred years in the future, if we're all still here.
Yeah.
Because these ancient wisdoms still evolve. They're not static. But the core essence is static. But the way they're taught has to evolve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was my overriding factor to my fear that you very well presented. If you can dilute and deform some ancient wisdom if you throw too many alien words in it or steer it towards science. I was just trying to use a vast vocabulary to help explain it, what I was trying to explain.
No, I think you
did
a good job with that, yeah. Because it seems to me that your book, while filled with content, it goes very in-depth. It's also a book that I think someone who's never encountered this material before could pick up and understand.
Yes, and that was one big driver. I also did that with my previous book, Wakey Wakey. Someone could just go from square one all the way. With this, with Trinity of Wisdom, I really wanted just to write the Kabbalah and the Emerald Tablet and the Merkabah sections.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, well, this is only going to appeal to a very small audience. But if I can explain, well, this is the state the species is in. This is what we can do about it. Here's some information about the science, or should we say the reality of our being and our reality, you know, in the solar system and on the Earth. Then look at some history. And then hopefully it can bring a lot more people in because it's tangible.
Now, one thing that I thought was also notable about the book, there's obviously many things, but one that stood out to me is your discussion about shamanism, DMT, and ayahuasca. Because again, when I look at books on Kabbalah or alchemy, this is something that's often not addressed.
Sure.
Or if it is addressed in any way, it's simply that use of any kind of chemical substance outside of a relationship with an established teacher is strictly forbidden and can cause tremendous harm and disrupt any kind of spiritual growth for at least this lifetime, possibly others.
There is a danger. I won't say there isn't, Greg, for sure. I was invited to an ayahuasca ceremony once or twice, and I had deep, deep meditations on it. Should I go? Shouldn't I go? And I looked around for the signs, and each time it was poignant, clear as day, I should go.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, there was some very respected shaman each time, very well known, not like celebrity well known, but well known in those sort of areas, should we say.
Mm-hmm.
And the experiences I had were very much milestone experiences. I mean, someone working with the Kabbalah or with the Enneagram or with some tantric symbols, I mean, we're trying to change consciousness in a controlled manner. That is a lot of the essence of many, many ancient teachings. We're trying to change our physiology and consciousness in a controlled manner. Some of these shamanic plants can do, it's a bit of a shortcut. Now, I think I say later in the book that the ayahuasca is like you go in the back door.
Mm-hmm.
But the Emerald Tablet, or working deeply with the Unwritten Kabbalah, you get invited in the front door and there's a cup of tea waiting. It is better to do it the natural way. I want to say that very clearly. Because sometimes you don't have a spare 50 days or a spare 100 days. And sometimes someone may need to shift a lot of energy. Some humans carry a lot of trauma or emotional baggage, mm-hmm. or they want some questions answered. Then the shamanic route can come in useful. And I don't really like to label myself. I don't even label myself a Kabbalist or a Hermetist. I'm just studying stuff. And I have a deep interest on mysticism and consciousness. And I found the ayahuasca very, very revealing. And if anyone is deep within the Kabbalah and understands the Kabbalah in a deep level and has a good shaman with them and does one of these experiences and in their consciousness starts looking at the tree of life, I can assure you some new things are going to come up. I can assure you mm-hmm. because of the reservoir in astral that the tree of life has built up is so strong that if you tap up your consciousness using shamanic plants in a very controlled, respectable manner, there are more insights there. There is more information there. I think it's Terence McKenna once said, you know, and the game there is to bring something back to help. Again, it's not for wonder. It's not for, wow, I had an experience. I saw this and that. It's you're a warrior out there. You've got to go and bring something back to help, mm-hmm. whether you fix yourself, whether you come back with an idea to make people happy or to heal people. The game is to bring something back each time. And however we can do that, it's really good. And there's a big misconception with the shamanic plants. I've heard the word drugs used many times, and I've heard people using it for fun or entertainment. And this I don't advocate at all. It's a very sacred experience. It should be done in a very controlled manner. And it has been since 3,000-4,000 BC being done this way in Mesoamerica and South America and other parts of the world. And I see at the moment, you know, the sort of touristy trips to South America to do ayahuasca weekends is growing massively. Why is that? People want answers. Mm. And people are thinking, you know, is this my life? Going to work every day, driving the car, turning the telly on. People's souls are screaming, Greg. They're looking for answers. And a lot of these people don't have a spare 50, 100 days to do, you know, a large alchemical experience.
Well, I appreciate the way that you addressed it. Personally, I agree with it. I think it's just like the control system. It really can't be ignored in modern society because these sacred plants are so readily available and provide the experience when done in a respectful, yeah. sacred, ceremonial way. That you're right. Yeah, it would take a lot of time and a tremendous amount of effort for people to achieve otherwise.
There are stories of HIV being cured. There are stories of cocaine addiction being cured. There are some people with rape trauma being cured. There are some really great stories out there, and these should be always kept at the fore instead of the word drugs and the word, you know, going for a bit of fun in Peru. It's a fine line, but the subject of these shamanic plants is always getting bigger and bigger these days, and it is something that is getting more and more mainstream. I'm just worried it's going to turn into a sort of backpacker's fun thing to do on their tick lists. So I have a little concern about that.
Yeah, I can see why. I mean, to me, that type of attitude is really disrespectful to the plant, to oneself, and that's, I imagine, where a lot of problems occur, where you hear people talk about how this can, using these substances can really be detrimental. Just like I think doing any kind of spiritual work with a disrespectful or confused intention can be detrimental.
You'll get your bum bit. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Usually when you go into anything on any sort of higher plane, you'll get your bum bitten if you have that attitude, yeah, for sure.
Now, one of the things I just wanted to touch on is in the book you talk about some of your experiences with the ayahuasca, and mm-hmm. one in particular really resonated with me, and I'm still at a loss as to why it is, but you mentioned that you found yourself your consciousness transported through some other place or dimension, maybe, where you were sitting with beings of a higher level of consciousness. And I wondered if you just wouldn't mind talking about that for a moment.
Yeah, it's hard to explain in words. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was quite a heavy experience. Many things were going on. And then I sort of got thrust out by a very fractally organic thing. I mean, you can change that word for entity, being, energy, archetype, whatever you want. It could be something within inside me or something on the astral, something in another dimension. We're not going to know. They're just words, aren't they? And then I ended up at this sort of table with a little audience and some minds were there, intelligences. The form was too hard to explain. It's more like energy, color, feeling than anything tangible, you know, like an abduction where you say, I saw this and that. It's more feeling. And I just had this massive feeling that 1,000 years of humanity to these intelligences, stroke form, stroke being, stroke energies, 1,000 years of humanity was like a speck of dust. And I could really feel that. And I tried to ask some questions, you know, and it was difficult to get my faculties together. And it was just sort of like, acknowledge me, but it was very much like I was a speck of dust as well. And they sort of jangled some keys at me and said, much wiser people than you aren't allowed these. And then I was off again somewhere else. I mean, this was only like a 20-second experience of a very longer, more deeper, twisty experience, shall we say. But it was very profound, and I remembered it. And I wrote it down the next morning. And I can see it now as we talk about it, Greg. Yeah. I mean, this sounds to many listeners probably extremely crazy, you know, that people might think about LSD and tripping and stuff, but this was done in a very sacred way. The ayahuasca, there was no chemicals in there. It was a very controlled environment. And yeah, this is one of the experiences I had. And yeah, and I put it in the book. And I wasn't getting it, but I did. It's in there, mm-hmm. along with some other experiences.
Grateful that you did mention them, and I think it's always useful to learn from other people's experiences in this regard.
Sure.
Now, another very interesting section of the book, not that there's any that isn't interesting.
Oh, thanks, Greg.
But in particular, you spent some time discussing religion and religious systems and religious tradition. If you could tell us a little bit about the context in which you're discussing religious traditions, mostly Western religious traditions, in relation to the Trinity of Wisdom, basically.
Yeah. I thought it wise, if one's going to talk about Kabbalah and Hermetics, just have a little look at where it weaved its way through history. Very short, few pages, just a few snippets. And a few places in history where we can sort of pick it up and where it went a bit low again, where it peaked again. And looking at a few other sort of groups, like I have a little look at the Dionysus, the Mithra, a little bit about Pythagoras. All of this helps to create a backdrop, a good backdrop to when we go in deeper into the Kabbalah. I had a little look at Catholicism. I also had a look at Catholicism in my last book. And when I looked into the history of Catholicism, it looked very dark. You know, there's a lot of alchemists who were killed, a lot of hermetics who were killed, hence why many alchemical doctrine, talking about the Philosopher's Stone, hide it with talking about vegetables or planets, you know, all these sort of allegory. A lot of these texts are in allegory to hide it from the Catholics, because mm-hmm. they were killing people, yeah? And thousands of witches were killed. You know, this is really real stuff that we don't get taught in school. And the genocide of the Cathars, I mean, it's a deep, deep story, but the Cathars really just wanted their own Bible in their own language, and the Catholics weren't having that. I was just sort of looking at the question also of, okay, most of Europe was Catholic, but hardly anyone had actually read the Bible. And that really makes me think, well, that's a bit strange. And no one else thinks that's strange. It's like, oh, yeah, Europe's for Catholics, always been Catholic, blah, blah, blah. Well, why? If no one's read the doctrine, why are people giving their souls to a doctrine that they've never read. Mm. And that still goes on to this very day. And I wanted to just to make that link. Let's have a look at Dionysus as well, and Mithra, and how Constantine, how that sort of happened, how Catholicism was created. I mean, you could write whole books on it. So I just sort of very bite-sized, just to get people interested, a little backdrop. And look at some initiatic cults like Mithras at the time. This all ends up sort of leading into the birth of how Kabbalah got bigger and bigger, really. We'll also look at the Essenes as well, and a little bit about what they were up to. It's very interesting to look at some of these other groups that were around, you know, for the past few thousand years. It really mm-hmm. gives a good backdrop. It's weird. I mean, someone does religious education at school these days. I don't even think Hermetics gets talked about. It's just unbelievable. In history, Hermetics doesn't get talked about. I really believe it's impossible to know, have a good grasp about history of our species if you don't know much about the occult or Hermetics.
Yeah, that's a good point. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, because my own research into this very question has revealed what I think is part of the reason for the lack of clarity or even discussion about this is the origins of what we call hermetics or hermetism are quite murky in history.
Yeah, and sure. I've said the same in my book.
Yeah, and you talk
those
about
those who write books saying they know. I have to say, hey, I mean, it's so murky. You have to be very brave to be putting your name to knowing
right
the roots.
And then you have Casaubon. I forget when this was. Who came along and essentially proved that the Corpus Hermeticum did not originate in ancient Egypt. It was more likely around the 2nd century AD or thereabouts, that it was at least written down. I don't know that it was necessarily composed and thought of then, but
yeah,
that's when they recorded it.
Yeah, we can only really pick up Corpus Hermeticum from the Renaissance period, really, when we can really tangibly get hold of it.
And then what you just mentioned, the Renaissance, that introduces another wrinkle, because at least scholars and some esotericists have put forward, and I think correctly, that the hermetics from ancient Alexandria, which they call Hermetism, is distinct and separate from the hermetics that were taught and espoused during the Renaissance period, which they refer to as Hermeticism. And the two are related, but not the same thing.
I have come across this distinction as well in some books, Greg. I mean, I'm in southern Spain at the moment, and you've also got some, I mean, Cordoba was a Kabbalistic, I mean, you could say Hermetic school. And that's also got a lot of Persian and Arabic and North African links. So there are so many different trains and avenues, and the way it weaved through history, it really is murky, but very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. So I've said this in the book. Mm-hmm. It's very murky, and I've just picked on some very tangible handles that I could grab and say, hey, yeah, Renaissance, we can pick this up. Around this century, we can pick that up. I don't want to waste too much of my time being a historian. I mean, I've covered some history and I've checked the dates, but I don't want to get lost in a history of hermetics. Mm-hmm. So another thing I want to say is a lot of books that are just about the history of the hermetics, the history of Kabbalah. But why don't we do some hermetics and Kabbalah and write about how we felt, you know? Mm. It just seems like a bit odd.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Everything seems a little bit too hod. All the books are very hod. I mean, if you're going to talk about the Quran, I'm sure you should be talking from every sephira, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know how much of, like, the academic training is responsible for this, because I know a book like yours is valuable because you're writing from personal experience, whereas a book like on the history, someone's gone into a library and pulled out X number of books and gone through them and tried to create some kind of argument based on other scholars, and any kind of practical experience is something that, unless you are, you know, a tenured professor somewhere, is immediately thought, you know, yo, you're really not qualified to make any kind of pronouncement on the subject.
I'm completely with you on that, Greg. Yeah, I think there needs to be more heartfelt, open texts about how people felt and what they experienced doing this stuff. It just gets a bit too hot, and people are just writing about dates and linking 1,000 pantheons to each sephira, and it just gets a bit dull. Mm. I mean, to go a step further, I've read a lot of Rosicrucian documents, but I'm not a Rosicrucian. I went to a meeting of theirs, and just out of curiosity, and there were guys in suits, and they were so dull, but they spoke a lot of great Gnostic truth. You know, it was great Gnostic truth. They were just, I thought they were going to die. It was just like, there was no heart. It was all hod.
Mm.
And that just sums a lot of this stuff up for me, yeah, at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be more heartfelt, open stuff about it, a bit of creativity in there.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I'd like to, if you could, you do this in the book, and you talk about the differences between what could be called Judaic or Judaistic Kabbalah versus Hermetic Kabbalah, which is often identified with a Christianized Kabbalah. So if you could sort of demystify that for us just a little bit.
Yeah, it can get very murky. And again, there are books and books and books that will try and explain it. But I made a very, very tangible separation. The Judaistic Kabbalah doesn't touch the tarot. It doesn't really touch astrology. It doesn't really do path working, shall we say. It's very much Hebrew numerology based, and very much looking at the Old Testament, especially the books of Moses. I believe, from what I hear, you have to be over 40 and you have to be male to actually get into one of these schools in Israel. The Hermetic side, I mean, you can throw in the Hermetic doctrines, the alchemical doctrines, the tarot, the astrology, scrying or pathworking, whatever you want to call it. So the toolbox is a lot bigger. Now, there are some that say that the Judaistic Kabbalists aren't happy because you have to know Hebrew. And all this is rules, and I think spirituality, there shouldn't be any rules. If something works for you, you run with it. So the main separation that's very tangible is the tarot and the astrology and the pathworking. Yeah, go on top of the tree of life. I mean, someone could work with a Kabbalah all their life and not know Hebrew. You don't have to. You don't even have to. You can work with the tarot and the tree. You could just work with the tree. It's a toolbox. It's like a toy box, and you can pick what you want to play with. Yeah, that's the way I like to look at it.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty deep stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we try to make it interesting for the people listening. Yeah. So
sure.
But definitely in the next section, I want to get pretty deeply into the Kabbalah, and then kind of where we go from here, because your last section of the book I thought was very hard hitting, and depending on one's outlook could be pretty frightening.
Yeah, sure.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Mark Knight discusses the Merkabah tradition, the unwritten Kabbalah, his perception of future changes, and much more. Don't miss it. Join now to check it out. The membership section features loads of additional recorded interviews and more. You can find a link to it on the side of the occultofpersonality.net website.
Thank you. is stirring and shifting the blinds. The motions of airflow dance across the skin, rekindles a fire that once lived within. As dusk flows to nightfall, the stopped raven sky, redemption's discovered in the sacred moon's light. Yet unseen.